This is the ASC podcast brought to you by the Communications Committee of the Association for Surgical Education. Embracing the mission of excellence, innovation, and scholarship, the ASC is impacting surgical education globally.
Sarah Lund, a general surgery resident at Mayo Clinic, and I'm excited to welcome Dr. Amanda Cooper to speak during an ASC podcast. Dr. Cooper is an acute care and trauma surgeon at Penn State Milton S. Hershey Medical Center, where she has been faculty since 2014. She is a graduate of Vanderbilt University Medical School and the Indiana University General Surgery Residency Program. She's a former associate program director for the general surgery program at Penn State and is the current vice chair of diversity, equity, and inclusion for the department. She's been a member of ASC since 2018 and serves as the chair of the DEI committee. Welcome, Dr. Cooper. I'm excited to speak with you today regarding the topic of bias in learner assessments. To get us started, can you share a little bit about your experience with bias in learner assessment, either as an instructor, a learner, or both?
Thank you, Sarah, for that very kind introduction. And I'm really excited to be here to talk to you about this topic today. I know it is very much an interest of yours, so hopefully we'll get some of your perspectives as well. So the first thing that comes to mind when I think about bias in learner assessments are two things, really. One, as a faculty member, I was part of our CCC for a number of years. And often we would have conversations about individual residents at the CCC, and a lot of the conversations either revolved around technical skills or sort of interprofessional communication and kind of professionalism, but more so on the communication aspect. Mm-hmm. And it seemed as though most of the conversations that we were having about communication skills were about our female residents, mm-hmm. and people, you know, thinking that they were a little bit pushy or, you know, had a negative tone of voice that was coming across. And every time those conversations would come up, I would cringe a little bit and, you know, sort of stop people and ask the question of, would we be having the same conversation if this were a male resident? Mm-hmm. So I think sort of stopping and asking that question maybe prevented some of the bias that might have actually come through in the assessment. Mm-hmm. But the fact that that information is what's getting filtered through to the CCC in the first place is definitely something that I think we as a surgical community need to be aware of and sort of thinking critically about. And it's tough because obviously the feedback that you get from nurses and from other physicians and other residents, you don't want to just discount. And people's impression is to some extent reality, but I think, you know, society in general conditions us to have certain role expectations for people. And being a surgeon often asks that you, as a woman, work against those role expectations. And I think that can certainly come through in assessment sometimes. And sort of in a similar vein, I think my own personal experience as a resident, there were many times where I would be in the trauma bay or seeing consults in the ED, and I would get pushback from nurses about doing orders that I had written or, you know, doing things that I asked them to do. And while that's not exactly an official assessment, it certainly impacts my ability to be effective as a resident and can potentially then impact my assessments. So I think sometimes these things can be pretty subtle, but something that we should all be looking out for.
Yeah, definitely. It sounds like the impact of unconscious bias kind of at every level and every moment of working even. I know this may be kind of intuitive for most of our audience, but I'm wondering if you can tell us more, to share with our audience a little bit more about why, as surgical educators, we should really care about the presence of this bias in the assessment, if, as you said, observations are kind of reality.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of reasons. One, You know, I think if we're going to be thoughtful surgical educators, we want to make sure that our assessments are measuring what we intend for them to measure. Mm-hmm. And bias is certainly not one of the things that we intend for them to measure. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the pragmatic reason. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing that I find a little bit even more compelling than that is when we think about diversifying the surgical workforce, we often talk about needing to improve the pipeline or build up pathway programs and get more people applying to surgery or even applying to medicine. And while I certainly think that's important and definitely invest time and energy into those programs, those take a long time to change the actual face of the surgical workforce. So I think the other thing that we don't talk as much about is attrition rates in surgery. And there's definitely data that says attrition rates are higher for underrepresented minorities in surgery and even women in surgery. And while it's difficult to study, some of the studies that have tried to look at that have shown, you know, that maybe lower performance or lower assessment, it may contribute to that to some degree. Now, certainly it's multifactorial and things like discrimination and bias and, you know, feeling like you don't have support are also very important factors. But I think this is one factor that is actually within our control. And if we can minimize bias in assessments and assure that we are fairly assessing our female residents and our underrepresented minority residents, we might be able to have a positive impact on attrition rates for those groups and therefore diversify our surgical workforce a little bit more immediately than we can through pathway programs.
No, definitely. And then provide better care for our diverse patient population.
Absolutely.
Of course.
Yeah.
And that makes a lot of sense. I'd love to hear more because we've talked a little bit about how bias can kind of impact you all the way through, whether that's in the moment to moment with nursing staff in the trauma bay, at your CCC meeting, as a faculty is filling out an evaluation form. What are some ways that we can, as surgical educators, mitigate the impact of that bias?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think one is being aware of it and sort of stopping yourself in the moment and asking yourself, you know, would I be making the same assessment in a different resident who belongs to a different demographic group? So I think that's one way. I think unconscious bias training can also be effective. But some of the other things that can be done are, you know, trying to rely on criterion-based assessments as opposed to normative assessments. So assessments where you're comparing somebody's performance to other people at that level are much more likely to be influenced by bias than assessments that are, for example, EPAs, where you have specific things that you're saying, can this person do X, Y, and Z? So there's not tons of data on this yet, and I'm hoping we'll someday have this data, but criterion-based assessments are thought to be less prone to bias. So trying to sort of make sure that you're designing your assessments so that they're criterion-based rather than normative-based.
No, I love that. I think the more subjective your assessment is, the more prone to bias it would be.
Right. The other thing is, you know, by nature, in medicine, we have some subjective assessments because it's workplace-based assessment and you're watching people's performance. But the more that you can have multiple people assessing somebody and have multiple observations that those assessments are based on, the less likely they are to be biased as well. And there's also some data to suggest that if you have a more diverse group of assessors, there may, at least in some circumstances, be lower rates of bias too. So I think, again, the importance of diversifying our surgical workforce, but also trying to assure that we're not basing our assessments on a limited number of observations by a small number of people.
Sure. I think I've heard, I think those are incredible ideas and options for mitigating the impact of bias. In your experience, are there things that don't work well or the things that surgical educators should steer away from or that aren't as effective maybe as what you've presented? And it's okay if not, I'm just curious.
I can't think of any off the top of my head that are less effective. The big thing that comes to mind is when you're assessing applicants for surgical residency, if you're one of your criteria for assessment is that they're fit for the program, sort of using that as a criteria tends to get you more people who are like the people you already have.
Got it.
So if you don't have a very diverse program to begin with, you're going to rate people who are different than the people who are already there a lot lower. So trying to stay out of that mindset of, is this person going to fit in here? Mm-hmm. Do they fit the surgical personality when mm-hmm. you're assessing your medical students? You know, that sort of relying on that as one of your criteria is going to lead you towards more biased assessments.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense. I think it's that same idea. If you're subjectively assessing that person, or you're thinking, oh, how well do they fit in? You're much more likely to think, oh, they fit me, or they right. reflect my characteristics. And so,
exactly.
and then you attract folks who are the same as you instead of a more diverse group. Makes a lot of sense. I think there's been some talk out there with respect to assessments and using blinding or not knowing characteristics yes. of the folks you're assessing. I'm curious your thoughts about them.
Yeah, I think so there's two sides to that. Mm-hmm. So I think for things like AOA membership, blinding is very effective. Mm-hmm. So that's actually how we do it at Penn State. We've been mm-hmm. doing it for, I don't know exactly how long, but at least the last 4 or 5 years, because I've been involved in it for that long. But we're blinded when we review the applications. Now, I don't know if the initial screen, if they're blinded at that level or sure. not, but the people who actually score them, and then they use the scores as the cutoff to decide who makes AOA, are completely blinded. You don't know who the person is. Now, sometimes you get some sense from how they answer the essays. And occasionally I know the student well enough to be pretty sure I know who the student is,
sure.
but in general, you don't know who it is. And so I think since we've gone to that method, we've had a more diverse group of students inducted into AOA at Penn State. So I think in that sense, it can work. I'm a little bit conflicted about it from the resident sense. So I think holistic review is probably more effective than blinding.
Sure.
So I sort of redesigned the scoring system for our applications to follow the principles of holistic review. And one of the things that we take a look at is sort of distance traveled. And so that takes into account things like, are they a first generation college graduate? Are they an immigrant? Did they have to work all throughout college and medical school, things like that? And so while those things aren't necessarily a direct correlation to the demographic factors, those things are more common in your more diverse candidates. And so to some extent, if you're assessing your applicants looking for those things, it may be helpful to them for you to know if they belong to a diverse group. But I think in theory, you could also be completely blinded. And as long as you've sort of structured your criteria that you're evaluating them on to be looking for those things, it may not matter.
Yeah. I think that probably speaks to the challenges overcome throughout your life to get to that same place as someone who maybe didn't have those same challenges. And then also speaks to the ability to then interact with or engage with your patient population if you have that background of being the first member of your family who's gone to college, interacting with folks who don't have family members in college or who've never gone to college. I think you'll be able to establish that rapport maybe a little bit better.
Yeah, and I think I see this a lot with the medical students. So I teach the communications course for our first and second year medical students. Some of our medical students have a very hard time interacting with SPs without using not even just jargon, but without being able to speak at sort of a sixth or seventh grade reading level, which is the average reading level of somebody in the US. And we actually have an assignment in that course where we have them reply to a quote patient email that we send them. And it's really interesting to read them because sometimes they're three paragraphs long and they have really long, complicated sentences with really big words. And, you know, I always try to give them the feedback of, you know, the average person in the US reads at a sixth or seventh grade reading level. It's actually really hard to write at that level. But if you've never grown up around somebody who didn't go to college, you may not be used to talking to people in that way. And so I think you know, our students and residents who come from a family where they have family members like that have an easier time of saying, how would I explain this to my mom or my grandma or my aunt or whomever it is in their family, than people who haven't grown up, you know, with those people close to them.
Yeah, definitely. And I can see that idea of holistic review, maybe not focused solely on those demographic criteria, but a bigger picture view of looking at those challenges overcome. Or I love the idea of that journey, the length of the journey to get to that point. That makes a lot of sense. I know probably a lot of folks listening are saying, well, we want to decrease bias in our assessment, but we feel like it's just so hard to do.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit about what the barriers are to decreasing bias or mitigating the effect of bias and maybe how we can overcome those.
Yeah, I think there are several barriers. One, I think sometimes it can be hard to sort out what is bias in the assessment strategy versus what is potentially bias in the way we are training our residents or our medical students versus what is bias in the learning environment. And they certainly all interact, and in some cases probably are all working against our learner. But just sort of knowing which one is contributing what can be hard to sort out. And so the example that comes to mind for that are MCAT scores. So the people who have done psychometric testing of the MCAT say the test itself is not inherently biased, but yet we still know that, you know, lower people from a lower socioeconomic status and minorities score lower on the MCAT. And that's multifactorial. But part of it is lack of access to study materials and prep courses and things like that, that are more learning environment and sort of systemic things. Part of it is that we're using those scores in ways they were never intended to be used. So those tests were designed to have a certain cutoff above which it predicts that, you know, the learner will be able to be successful in medical school. They weren't designed to say somebody who gets a really high score versus a, you know, above the mean score is going to do a lot better. But yeah, that's how we use them. So part of it is that we're using assessments in ways they were never designed to be used. And part of it is that, you know, there's a whole lot of systemic things that are working against some of our underrepresented and lower socioeconomic status learners. So I think that can make it tough too.
Definitely. And I hear that, especially when we talk about step one or step two, those assessments were never designed, as you mentioned, to actually segregate that highest level of learner. They were only designed to say, okay, you are you're board certifiable as a physician and above this cutoff. So I think it makes a lot of sense to maybe treat those assessments the way that they were designed instead of in other ways. It speaks to the direction we're heading with pass fail for step one and maybe in the future.
And that was really a lot of the rationale behind making the switch for step one to be pass fail. I don't know that the actual application has turned out quite the way that it was intended, at least in surgery, because I think people are really largely just relying on step two scores to differentiate, but hopefully it's helping at least a little bit.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So I think I love that trick of knowing what your assessment intended to assess and kind of only using it in that way. Are there maybe tricks for designing assessment tools to decrease bias, or when we don't have an assessment that's effective, what can we do?
Yeah, so I think a couple of things. One, being really clear on what you're trying to assess and making sure that the assessment you're designing actually assesses the thing you're intending to assess. So that's just sort of good principles of psychometrics, but that is certainly an important component. But I think also trying to make sure that you have some diversity in the group of people who are deciding what you should be assessing and also deciding how to design your assessment is probably a very effective strategy, because you sort of don't know what you don't know. And if it's the thing that comes to mind is thinking about the FES exam. So there's a study that looked at the FES exam and found that women score lower than men. And then they sort of did an assessment where they adjusted for glove size and height. And that decreased the difference. It didn't completely eliminate the difference, but it did decrease the difference. And so if you're a male surgeon who doesn't have any problem using an endoscope single-handedly, it may not occur to you that if you're me and you have a size six hand, it's really hard to manipulate an endoscope with one hand because they're not designed for somebody with hands that size. But if you have women who are also helping with that assessment, they're going to know that. And so they're going to think about that when they design the assessment. So that's just one small example, but I think that holds true for any assessment.
No, and that's a very powerful example, because in that first study, the assumption might be made that, oh, women are worse at endoscopy than men, not that there's some other factor playing in. And so then should women be endoscopists, right? I can imagine the argument that comes from that first study, but the follow-up of, oh, we involve women in the assessment, we understand that, oh, this, the difference maybe is actually your hand size, your stature, your ability to manipulate the instrumentation, not so much the skill itself. And that's what's driving the difference, and that that would impact any man the same if they had a size six glove or a size six hand. That makes a lot of sense. I know you mentioned that the presence of bias in the learning environment and even bias within the assessors may then influence the outcome of the assessment. I'm wondering if there are other strategies our learners can undertake to mitigate bias in those two settings as well. I know we've talked about a few already, but...
I think it's really tough when you're the learner, because for a couple of reasons. One, because you often don't know how other people are being assessed, right? You're not always around your peers when they're being assessed. So you may not even realize the bias every time that it's there, because you may just assume everybody's being treated the way you're being treated. And in cases where you know there's bias there, it can be very tricky to speak up and say anything about it, because the person that you're reporting for having bias is also doing your assessment. So that gets very, very tricky. So I think it's important that we try not to put it on our learners so much, that we are really thinking about it as the educator and the assessor.
I love that. And I think kind of going back to something you mentioned earlier, the idea of having multiple assessors from different backgrounds, right? You mentioned being in that CCC room and being able to say, would we talk about that if this was a man advocating for your learner from your background and your knowledge, I think then, and your experience then can help decrease the impact of bias.
Absolutely.
But if you have one assessor looking at an applicant or a resident or a medical student, then that can be very challenging. Definitely. We've kind of talked or run the gamut when it comes to types of learners, but are there differences in the way bias impacts medical students, residents, faculty when they're being assessed, do you think?
I think the main differences are in how we do assessments at each of those levels. So standardized tests obviously happen at all levels.
Of course.
I think there's less data about the psychometrics of the ABSITE than there are about MCAT and step one and step two. My guess is the psychometrics are probably reasonably sound for the ABSITE to measure what it's intended to measure. And so the bias is probably more of a learning environment and potentially misuse of the test relevant to the way it was intended to be used. I don't know that for sure though, because we don't really have that data, but and then I think the bias in subjective assessments has also been shown kind of at all levels. So there have been studies that have looked at clerkship narrative evaluations of students, MSPE evaluations, and shown that for surgery, women and minorities tend to have fewer sort of exemplary words used to describe them. The same is true in some studies that have looked at fellowship applications. The only one that didn't show that was in Sir Jonk applications, but that was a single institution study. And two is also a field where there are relatively more women than colorectal and transplant, which is what the other two studies were in. So again, that may speak to having a more diverse group of assessors being beneficial. But at the faculty level, there have been studies that have shown bias in that women surgeons get rated lower by trainees and also by patients.
Interesting.
So, you know, those sort of societal expectations and norms impact people throughout all levels of training. I think just as you move up and become faculty, there are fewer sort of standardized tests and fewer criterion-based assessments and a lot more subjective assessments that you're getting rated on.
Sure. That would make the presence of bias all the more and the need for maybe those criterion-based assessments at higher levels.
Yes.
Really important.
And I think, you know, it's hard to prove. There's not a lot of studies that have looked at this, but there have certainly been studies that have suggested that may explain some of the discrepancies in promotion rates
interesting.
For women surgeons and maybe even some of the discrepancy in the number of female surgical chairs that there are.
Sure.
So again, hard to know for sure, but certainly some cause for concern there.
Definitely, definitely. And I know we've talked a little bit about the data that exists out there. I'm curious what your thoughts are about what areas are understudied. Where do we need to put our focus to better understand the presence and impact of bias in assessment?
Well, one of the big things is that the majority of the data is gender-based data, and that's multifactorial. I think the two biggest causes are one, that data is more readily available. Data on race and ethnicity is becoming more readily available in the last few years, but you know, 10, 15 years ago, that data wasn't readily available. And two, as the percentage of women in surgery has gone up, the minority group has become larger, so it's therefore easier to study. So when you have a minority group that only has a few people in it, you can't really do single institution studies and have very much power. And you have to be pretty thoughtful about how you design even multi-institution studies to make sure that you're preserving the anonymity of the learner.
Of course.
And if you have a small enough group, you risk losing anonymity by identifying their demographic characteristics. So a number of people that have done these studies have said, you know, great, we've done studies looking at men versus women. We need to look at other genders as well. Those studies are going to be really hard to do just because one, we don't really have that data because most people aren't asking people to disclose that in a way that's available for people to study. And two, it's going to be a very small group. So it's going to be, you're going to need a very big study to get that group to be large enough to draw any meaningful conclusions. So I think ideally we need more studies looking at race and ethnicity, and there are some out there, but we need to keep doing those. Hopefully we'll eventually be able to do studies about, you know, gender and sexual minorities. But again, we have to be really thoughtful about how we design those studies.
Of course.
And then I think the other thing that's maybe a little bit more feasible, but not super easy to do either just because of availability of data, is more research on people coming from a background that's low socioeconomic status or first generation. And the first generation in particular is a little bit hard to come by, but there's some data sets that will at least know the education level of the parents, probably mostly at the medical student level. I don't know that anybody has that data at the resident level.
Yeah.
But, you know, sort of trying to prospectively collect some of that data could help us eventually get those studies as well.
Definitely. And I love your comment about that those data just weren't readily available until recently, especially race data. And that can be challenging. If we don't know what we don't know, then we can't solve the problem. If we can't study it, then we can't make the argument that there is a problem. And one of the ways to get around it's such a small group is to look historically and to look over 10 or 15 years and see what's happened in that cohort. But if we don't have the data from 10 years ago, then we can't do those types of analyses. So to actually gather, instead of this idea of, oh, we shouldn't be looking at the things that make us different from each other, actually gathering those data so that we can look at it and diagnose the problem and then make efforts to fix it can be really important, I think.
The one thing we do have to be a little bit careful about is if we're designing survey data to kind of measure these things, then the concept of stereotype threat becomes important. So if you're asking people at the beginning of the survey if they're a woman, if they belong to a racial or ethnic minority, it may actually influence the way they answer the questions, especially if they're doing self-assessment. So we just have to be cognizant of that if we're designing survey studies and include the demographic data ideally at the end so that stereotype threat is not impacting our results.
And that's a great pearl for our listeners, many of whom are educators who do a lot of survey-based work, I'm sure, that your demographics don't always have to come at the beginning of your survey. They can definitely be at the end. Lovely. Well, as we draw to a conclusion here, I just want to leave our listeners with kind of a lasting message with respect to bias and learner assessment. What's the underlying takeaway you want our listeners to get from this podcast?
I think one, it exists and we need to be aware of it, mm-hmm. And work to overcome it, but to think about it as one of your strategies to increase diversity in the surgical workforce, and working against bias and assessment as sort of a tool to help promote mm-hmm. Diversity in our workforce.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And then for listeners who have additional questions, what's the best way for them to reach you or contact you?
Probably email is the easiest thing. Okay. So my email address is acooper2@pennstatehealth, all one word, .psu.edu.
Perfect. Well, thank you, Dr. Cooper, for your time. And thank you all for listening to this enlightening episode of the ASC podcast series.
And that wraps up another edition of the ASC podcast brought to you by the Communications Committee of the Association for Surgical Education. You can check out many great resources on the ASC website at www.surgicaleducation.com. And be sure to subscribe to our podcast series where we discuss pressing issues in surgical education. We invite you to join the ASC and get involved, and wish you much success in your pursuit of surgical education excellence.